Fasten your seatbelt, turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. In our national mythology, the U.S. Supreme Court holds a special, almost ethereal place in our system of constitutional government. Nine justices in black robes, appointed for life, removed from the day-to-day political conflicts of the executive and legislative branches, impartially and fairly applying and interpreting the clearly defined words in the sacred document that provides the framework for our American government. That view of one of our co-equal branches of government has been severely strained with the passage of time. From Andrew Jackson's words, "Judge Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it," to the Civil War years when the division between our state and federal governments erupted in bloodshed, to the post-war era of segregation and separate but equal, to the revolution of the liberal Warren Court, and now to the past 30 years of conservatism, led by a man who called himself a strict constructionist and originalist, but who critics labeled as one of the most partisan and activist justices in the history of the court. The death of Antonin Scalia in a starkly divided nation in an election year has opened old wounds and reopened old debates about the nature of government and the constitutional obligations of the president to appoint a new justice and the Senate to advise and consent. Our guest today is UW Stevens Point constitutional law expert John Blakeman, the author of The Supreme Court and the New Federalism, From the Rehnquist to the Roberts Court. What do you think? Does President Obama have an obligation to name a new justice? And is the Senate shirking its constitutional responsibilities by not holding hearings? Or should this nomination be left to a new president after the people have a chance to weigh in? If you've got questions or opinions, you can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. John Blakeman, welcome to Route 51.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Glenn.
And as the Chinese curse goes, we live in interesting times. In your study of the Supreme Court and the sometimes rough partisanship in this country, so rough that it did lead to a civil war at one time, how unusual do you think these times are? How steep is the partisan divide, given our long history?
Well, during an election year, the partisan divide tends to get pretty high, for sure. But if you're talking about the partisan divide on the Supreme Court or in the way we perceive the Supreme Court, I would say in over 200 years of history, things probably haven't changed all that much. I mean, we start with a highly partisan court in the 1790s. We have one today, and it's actually not all that unusual.
Well, we've had a lot of controversial 5-4 decisions, some of them pretty consequential, some overturning long judicial precedent. And in one case, Bush v. Gore, according to some critics, it led to an appointment of a president of the United States. How crucial is this Scalia seat on the Supreme Court to these recent decisions?
It's a crucial seat in the sense that it is a solid conservative seat. And without Justice Scalia on the bench or a conservative to replace him, the court is now effectively divided 4-4 between a more conservative wing and a more moderate to liberal wing.
And what's that going to mean if that seat isn't replaced with a new justice in the next year?
Well, what it will mean immediately is for a handful of very high-profile cases that are pending at the court right now. Affirmative action coming out of Texas, a voting rights case, again, coming out of Texas, the union speech case coming out of California, there's now a real possibility that each one of those could be decided 4-4, in which case the lower court decision stands, and those lower decisions are generally in a more liberal direction.
If you put a liberal in the Scalia seat, how would that change the future trajectory of American history?
Honestly, I don't think it would change the trajectory of American history long term. I think it means in the short term you have a court that is 5-4 in the more moderate to liberal leaning side, and that can last as long as the next appointment becomes available.
Well, Antonin Scalia's body was still warm when the talk turned from his legacy to the politics of replacing him. We had Senator Mitch McConnell flatly urging President Obama not to put forward a nominee and warning that if one was put forward, there would be no confirmation hearings. And then not long after that, the president made a brief statement paying tribute to Justice Scalia's memory, followed by a promise that he would indeed fulfill what he viewed as his constitutional duties. We're going to hear some of the sounds of this past week. Senator Ted Cruz and businessman Donald Trump at the Republican debate in South Carolina, then Senator McConnell, and finally the remarks of the president.
We are one justice away from a Supreme Court that will strike down every restriction on abortion adopted by the states. We are one justice away from a Supreme Court that will reverse the Heller decision, one of Justice Scalia's seminal decisions that upheld the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. We are one justice away from a Supreme Court that would undermine the religious liberty of millions of Americans. And the stakes of this election for this year, for the Senate needs to stand strong and say, we're not going to give up the U.S. Supreme Court for a generation by allowing Barack Obama to make one more liberal appointee.
So just to be clear on this, Mr. Trump, you're okay with the president nominating somebody?
I think he's going to do it, whether I'm okay with it or not. I think it's up to Mitch McConnell and everybody else to stop it. It's called delay, delay, delay.
I believe the overwhelming view of the Republican Conference of the Senate in the Senate is that this nomination should not be filled. This vacancy should not be filled by this lame duck president.
The Constitution is pretty clear about what is supposed to happen now. When there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, the President of the United States is to nominate someone. The Senate is to consider that nomination, and either they disapprove of that nominee or that nominee is elevated to the Supreme Court. Historically, this has not been viewed as a question. There's no unwritten law that says that it can only be done on off years. That's not in the constitutional text. I'm amused when I hear people who claim to be strict interpreters of the Constitution suddenly reading into it a whole series of provisions that are not there. There is more than enough time for the Senate to consider in a thoughtful way the record of a nominee that I present and to make a decision.
President Obama, also Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump, and Ted Cruz. John Blakeman, your response to what the president said and what Mitch McConnell said.
In a sense, they're both right. President Obama has indicated that there's a constitutional process. The Constitution commands the president, in a sense, to appoint justices to the Supreme Court and lower federal judges, too. McConnell is correct that the Senate has a role in offering its advice and consent. What the Constitution doesn't do is commit either branch to a specific time frame, and it doesn't commit the branches to a non-political process. And the appointment process has been politicized since George Washington's first nominations back in 1789 and 1790. And so to believe that there's not going to be any underlying politics underlying the appointment process is sort of folly, in a sense. Now, Senate Republicans, if President Obama nominates someone to the Scalia seat and Senate Republicans don't get around to dealing with the nomination until after the election, it won't be the first time it's happened, and it won't be the last time it's happened either. But given that, you know, public opinion right now is trending towards President Obama. The Pew Forum has pointed out that almost 60% of Americans want the president to nominate someone, and they want the Senate to have a hearing and a vote. And the Gallup poll sort of indicates the same thing. So sort of the best of all possible worlds is the president to nominate someone, the Senate Judiciary Committee holds hearings, and then the Senate votes yes or no. And most likely, given the politics, it would be a no vote.
But if the president is given that opportunity, he could very well nominate somebody that would be hard for some Republicans to turn down. The governor of Nevada, Brian Sandoval is being touted as a potential nominee. He's a Republican.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, that's just the underlying politics of it.
So that maybe that's
and,
John.
You know,
maybe
if President Obama nominates Governor Sandoval, and the Republican-controlled Judiciary Committee holds hearings and says, "Oh, we actually like this person after all, and he would make a good Supreme Court justice," then what's wrong with that? The process has worked.
But maybe that's why they don't want to hold any hearings at all, because they're holding out for somebody in the Scalia mold who would be a very conservative justice instead of a moderately conservative one.
That's certainly true. And then Senator McConnell is sort of banking on a Republican winning the White House in November and the Republicans maintaining control over the Senate. And arguably, those things are somewhat up in the air right now.
Is it likely or even possible that things would not go Mitch McConnell's way and, say, Hillary Clinton would be elected president or Bernie Sanders and the Democrats would take control of the Senate and there's no Supreme Court nominee and she could nominate Barack Obama? He's a constitutional law scholar.
Yeah, that's certainly true. That is one of many scenarios, and I guess I would put a low probability on that scenario. But it's simply one of many that the Republicans in the Senate have to take account of.
Now, the president, John, is being called a lame duck, but he's got more than 330 days, almost a full year left of his presidency. Doesn't the term lame duck historically mean the period after a new president is elected in November until that president is sworn in?
Well, historically, but we've been calling presidents in the very last term of office, in the very last year, lame ducks in this day and age. You know, you can certainly find the term used with George W. Bush, certainly with Bill Clinton, with George H.W. Bush, even with Ronald Reagan now. So when that term is thrown at the Obama administration, in a sense, it's how we commonly perceive the presidency now.
Now, this whole controversy has surfaced, as you would expect, in the U.S. Senate debate between Republican Ron Johnson and Democrat Russ Feingold. Yesterday, Johnson pointed to Obama's nomination of Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, and he said, quote, "He's got a track record. We know the type of justice he would appoint. We wouldn't confirm that individual."
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, certainly that's the prerogative of a sitting senator. And that shows you how deeply ingrained the politics are in the appointment process now. But to put that in context for you, President Obama has named two justices to the court now, potentially a third. If you consider that there are over 900 federal judges in the system already, President Obama has already appointed about 30% of them, which is typical for a two-term president. So the Senate Judiciary Committee has already passed through a lot of lower-level federal judicial appointees by President Obama, and it's likely that Senator Johnson has approved some of those, although I don't know for sure because I haven't looked at his voting record.
What we've heard from Democrats is that the kind of obstructionism that this president, President Obama, has faced is unprecedented in American history, but it sounds, from what you just said, that it's typical.
Oh, I think it's typical in terms of the numbers of people. I have the sense that it is a little, well, it is more obstructionist than normal. But at the end of the day, it's also just politics. And you could pick any two-term president and find a scenario where one or both houses of Congress are controlled by a different political party, and the obstructionism is going to be approximately the same.
How do you think all of this is going to play out?
Well, if you want my prediction, I think President Obama will name someone to fill the late Justice Scalia's seat. The Senate Judiciary Committee will be under enormous pressure to hold hearings. They'll probably end up holding hearings, and they'll probably end up denying the nomination.
We're going to take a short break for our pledge drive. We're talking to constitutional law expert John Blakeman of UW Stevens Point. Please give us your support and give generously at WPR.org. That's WPR.org or by calling 1-888-202-2552. Again, that's 1-888-202-2552. I'm Glenn Moberg. When we come back, we're going to listen to the words of Antonin Scalia and talk about his legacy on Route 51.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Peninsula Players, Ganchert Nursery, and Marshfield Clinic, proud supporters of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-law.com.
Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice.
As Peter Tosh takes us into our next segment on Route 51, we continue our discussion of the legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and the political battle over his replacement with UW Stevens Point constitutional law expert John Blakeman, the author of The Supreme Court and the New Federalism, From the Rehnquist to the Roberts Court. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you got questions or opinions about the topic and about whether President Obama and the Senate should move forward on a new nominee or if we should wait until after the presidential election, you can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page and I will read it live on the air. John, your book is titled The Supreme Court and the New Federalism, From the Rehnquist to the Roberts Court. Looking at the recent conservative history of that court, what is exactly the New Federalism?
Let me first acknowledge my co-author, Chris Banks, on that book, too. He's at Kent State University. Well, the New Federalism begins around the early to mid-1970s, and it's a reaction among more conservative federal judges and justices and politicians to what they see as the overreaching federal government. And in terms of the Supreme Court, the New Federalism really starts with Justice Rehnquist, who was appointed by Richard Nixon in the early 1970s. And Rehnquist began to articulate this constitutional doctrine based on the 10th Amendment and the structure of the Constitution itself that protects the states and state policymaking from the federal government, and especially from Congress's power under the Interstate Commerce Clause to put in place what we would call a lot of sort of police legislation, not mean policing necessarily, but public safety legislation, social policy legislation. And by the time Rehnquist becomes Chief Justice in the early 1980s, the New Federalism doctrines have really begun to develop and gel, and as the Supreme Court becomes more conservative in the 1980s and 1990s, there's a critical majority of justices on the court who will write the New Federalism into the Constitution. And the whole point of it, ultimately, is to sort of carve out protections for state policymaking from the federal government.
Would you consider Chief Justice Roberts, for instance, to be an advocate for this point of view? And what about Alito? I would assume that Scalia and Thomas are on board.
Yep, absolutely. Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, Chief Justice Roberts.
What about Kennedy?
Sandra Day O'Connor, Justice Kennedy, to a certain extent. Would all generally agree that the states need to be given more autonomy, that the Constitution creates a finely balanced structure between the states and the federal government. The 10th Amendment is only part of it, but that structure over the course of the 20th century tended to err on the side of the federal government. And even today, you would probably be able to find five justices on a divided court who would tend to agree with, in a sense, rolling back federal power in favor of protecting the state.
See, when I was in high school and college, and that's I'm going to date myself here, that's the late 60s, early 70s, I was taught that the issue of states' rights was decided by the Civil War. Essentially, when Robert E. Lee surrendered his sword to General Grant, we entered a new era of federal supremacy, and the states were subordinate pretty much in all things. One of the teachers that I had went so far as to say that the so-called states' rights amendment, the 10th Amendment, was rendered null and void by the 14th Amendment, which was passed after the Civil War, and that states should only essentially be administrative districts for enforcing and implementing federal policy. So we've moved away from that, if that was even a predominant philosophy at the time.
Sure, and that is the dominant New Deal philosophy too, that both political parties, the Democrats and Republicans, have subscribed to, that states are, to a certain extent, the policy implementers for federal policy. So if you look at New Deal policymaking, like the Agricultural Adjustment Act, for example, or labor laws, to a large extent, those are to be implemented by states. Environmental laws, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, you know, those were passed by a Republican administration.
Richard Nixon.
Those are meant to be implemented by the states to a certain degree, too. And the new federalism is, in a sense, a reaction against that. You know, even with the Civil War, the 10th Amendment is still part of the Constitution. The 11th Amendment, which no one ever remembers what that says, is still a vital protection for states, too.
Now, Justice Antonin Scalia famously was not only a strict constructionist, but an originalist, meaning the Constitution should only mean what it meant to the people who wrote it in the late 1700s. Here he is discussing his constitutional law philosophy of originalism with Chris Wallace of Fox News on July 29th of 2012.
Originalism is sort of a subspecies of textualism. Textualism means you're governed by the text. That's the only thing that is relevant to your decision, not whether the outcome is desirable, not whether legislative history says this or that, but the text of the statute. Originalism says that when you consult the text, you give it the meaning it had when it was adopted, not some later modern meaning. So
if it was the Constitution written in the 18th century, you try to find what those words meant in the 18th
exactly.
century.
Exactly. The best example being the death penalty. I've sat with three colleagues who thought it was unconstitutional, but it's absolutely clear that the American people never voted to proscribe the death penalty. They adopted a cruel and unusual punishments clause at the time when every state had the death penalty and every state continued to have it. Nobody thought that the Eighth Amendment prohibited it.
So there's Antonin Scalia arguing in favor of originalism, John Blakeman, and saying you might want to abolish the death penalty, but don't use the Constitution to do it.
That's right, yeah. And Scalia, he never really indicated what his preference about the death penalty was. He adamantly maintained that if states want to get rid of the death penalty, then they absolutely have the power to do that. It's just, as Scalia saw it, the Supreme Court should not be interpreting the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment clause to prohibit the death penalty. And, you know, to be fair to the Supreme Court, both conservative and liberal courts, the Supreme Court has never done that. Now, towards the end of his time on the bench, within the past couple of years, Scalia started to indicate in the media that he was concerned that a critical mass of the justices might now believe that the death penalty is unconstitutional, and they'll use the Eighth Amendment to do that. You know, he never really wrote that into a legal opinion at all. But then again, on the other hand, it's quite clear that state legislatures are trending against the death penalty now, too. And within the past decade, several states that historically are death penalty states have gotten rid of it.
So let me give you the reductio ad absurdum argument on originalism. Does that mean that the First Amendment freedom of the press only applies to what the founding fathers knew, pamphlets and books and newspapers, and not TV, radio, or the internet? And does it mean that the Second Amendment only applies to the kinds of armaments the founding fathers knew, single-shot rifles and pistols and muskets?
No, and I don't think Justice Scalia would go that far either. I mean, he was a very, I don't want to call him a First Amendment absolutist, but when it came to the free speech clause, when it came to the free press clause, he certainly extended freedom of the press to cover new media, in a sense. Although he would tend to agree that the government could regulate newer media like television broadcasts, radios, more than it could the printed word. I don't think Scalia would agree at all that the Second Amendment extends only to muskets and Kentucky long rifles. I think he was certainly willing to update the meaning of the Second Amendment to the current time.
Yeah, and I guess his critics would say, well, then you're no longer an originalist.
Right.
Critics argue that Scalia was also not restrained as a justice, that he was in fact an activist who overturned judicial precedent in the Citizens United decision, and they accuse him and the court majority of even stopping the vote counting in Florida and appointing George W. Bush as president in Bush v. Gore, which people say was a very activist thing to do.
Yes, Scalia was in that sense an activist, as was Chief Justice Rehnquist. They were more than willing, as other conservative justices have been as well, they were more than willing to vote to overturn what might be considered some longstanding precedents. When we talk about judicial restraint and judicial activism, we tend to forget that overturning a precedent is an activist decision, in a sense.
John,
it probably means we need to sort of redefine what we mean by those two words.
I think
it's a bit unfair to say Scalia sort of caused the outcome of Bush versus Gore. You know, there were four other justices on the court who sided with him to bring about that outcome.
All right, John, I got to take a quick break. We're in the middle of this pledge drive, and I've got to keep the train running on time. Please give us support and give generously at WPR.org or by calling 1-888-202-2552.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Chippewa Valley Cultural Association, Lee Yawkey Woodson Art Museum, and the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestras. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. Go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
As a WHO take us into our final segment on Route 51, we continue our discussion of the legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia with Stevens Point constitutional law expert John Blakeman, the author of The Supreme Court and the New Federalism. John, we've got a comment from Jim Moss, who's a libertarian activist. He says the arrogance of Republicans to assume that after months of candidates bashing each other, that one of them will become the president is astounding. He also says the Supreme Court was supposed to be a check on the power of the other two branches. And as we can all tell, the legislative and executive branches have grown in power. He says libertarians are not hopeful that this will end well.
Yeah. I like that lead-in music, by the way. But I think Mr. Moss raises several important points here. I wouldn't rule out a Republican winning the White House in November, but sometimes it does look increasingly unlikely. The separation of powers isn't supposed to be neat and tidy. It's supposed to be messy. And I always like to suggest to my students that when we see the Senate and the President disagreeing with each other and perhaps one branch acting more arrogant than the other, that means the framers' design of the separation of powers might actually be working a little bit. Now, the Supreme Court, yeah, part of its job is to check the other two branches, just as the Senate's job is to check the president and the Supreme Court, and the president's job is to check Congress and the Senate and the Supreme Court. So it's all this finely tuned and balanced system, and the system gets out of whack, and it takes a little time to write it, in a sense.
Let's talk briefly here, and it's got to be briefly because we're already running out of time, about Justice Antonin Scalia, the man. He was quite vocal, even scathing in his language, in his dissents, but yet he got along fabulously with his liberal counterpart, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They went out to dinner. They went to the opera together. They appeared on TV. And he cheered when another liberal, Sonia Sotomayor, was nominated and became a Supreme Court justice. So there you've got a throwback to the old ways where you can argue about policy, but when you're not working, you can get along with the people you disagree with.
Yeah. I think if you look at Justice Scalia's term on the court, 30 years, you know, you will see a justice who was very strident in his opinions. And sometimes his wit could become a little too acerbic for some of his colleagues, like Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. But at the end of the day, he respected his colleagues. He respected their intellect. He respected their background, their training. He respected their diversity. And even though he disagreed with a lot of people on public policy issues, I think it's that overriding respect. And that's something that the court has that the other two branches normally don't anymore, and that's too bad. But the justices themselves realize that they work as a tight-knit group. They have to. And they have to respect each other's opinions and intellects and background and diversity of education and so on and so forth if they're actually going to get anything done. And you say it's old school. Yeah, I think it unfortunately probably is old school. But at least in that sense, the Supreme Court is the one institution that we can sort of look to for modeling good behavior, if you want to put it that way.
John Blakeman, we are completely out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
We want to thank today's guest, UW-Stevens Point constitutional law expert John Blakeman, the author of The Supreme Court and the New Federalism, From the Rehnquist to the Roberts Court. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to Nick Schultz for her help with this program. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Peter Tosh and The Who. Next Thursday morning at 10 o'clock on Route 51, listen to this, folks, we will be broadcasting and hosting a free live concert featuring the legendary blues guitarist Greg Cook and the Tone Controls in the Veninga Theater at the Center for Civic Engagement on the UW-Marathon County campus in Wausau. Sponsored by Wisconsin Public Radio and the Great Northern Blues Society and their Blues in the Schools program. So you can listen in on this station, or better yet, simply show up at the theater. Admission is free. Again, that's next Thursday morning at 10 o'clock at the UW-Marathon County Center for Civic Engagement. Please remember to pledge to keep programs like this on the air at WPR.org or by calling 1-888-202-2552. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we're heading out of town.